Your silence is commanding.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We now call 2004 AP 2681, Stephen Wickenhauser versus Jack Layton. Arguing on behalf of the plaintiff petitioners is attorney Timothy O'Brien. On behalf of the defendants, appellants, is attorney Stephen Miller. Mr. O'Brien.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Miller, may it please the court. My name is Tim O'Brien. I represent Steve and Christy Wickenhauser. This case is not about an unenforceable contract. This case is not about affirming a contract to obtain damages. And this case is not about the election of remedies doctrine. This case is about fraudulent misrepresentation. It's a case about an intentional tort. It's a case about bringing your claim at a time of your choosing. In Cloudy Enterprises versus Kellogg, Justice Rogensack noted that Wisconsin has a long-standing principle that parties need a background of truth and fair dealing in contractual relationships. And where the matters fall outside the contract, courts should address a party's failure to act honestly with tort law. Misrepresentation is an intentional tort, and a party committing fraud should not be able to hide behind contract law, nor the archaic doctrine of election of remedies. But that is exactly what Mr. Lettinen is attempting to do. I would first like to address the election of remedies doctrine. Mr. Lettinen appealed the damage judgment in case 165 on the theory that Wickenhausers elected their remedy when they chose to raise fraud as one of their many defenses to his contract claim in case 134. That fraud, together with the other defenses, led the trial court to declare the contract void and return the parties to their previous position as mortgagee and mortgagor. Interestingly enough, if you read Judge Lundell's findings, in the fraud finding, he never used the term rescission. Rather, he talked about restoring them to their previous position. But regardless, the election of remedies has historically applied to situations where there are alternative but inconsistent remedies available to right a wrong. The classic example Lettinen cites numerous times in his briefs to this court and to the Court of Appeals. That's a breach of contract claim where the aggrieved party in contract must elect between avoiding the contractual obligation or seeking reimbursement for the damages caused by the breach. The remedies in such a case were inconsistent because one nullifies the contract while the other calculates damages based on the terms of the contract.
Mr. O'Brien, what are the components of the election of remedies doctrine?
The election of remedies doctrine itself talks about that in a contract setting, you either have to affirm the contract and seek the damages or performance of the contract and damages that would be available under performance, or rescind the contract and seek damages that you feel are appropriate. Well, excuse me, rescind the contract, be restored to your prior position, and seek restitution as your only damage.
Perhaps I wasn't very clear in my question, and that's my fault, not yours. I look at a discussion of the doctrine of Hidden Seaman versus Craig, a decision written by Judge Voss in the Court of Appeals. And on page 159 of that decision, Judge Voss points out that the underlying purpose is to prevent double recovery for the same wrong. The label election of remedies is frequently used as a cloak for an estoppel or ratification where, for example, it bars a suit for rescission of a contract subsequent to some act of affirmance of the contract. That's what Judge Voss saw as the election of remedies doctrine. I look at the language in Schwabe, and I don't have Schwabe in front of me right now, that talks in terms of bringing in alternative actions. And I guess my question and my concern, not concern, but my question regards what we're really looking at or talking about when we're talking about election of remedies. Is it simply rescission versus versus affirming the contract and damages, or are there other components that go along with that, including whether or not, as part of the election, the party making the election is seeking alternative remedies? Do you understand my question?
I believe so. And I think it's always been used in the contractual setting where it seems to have gotten mixed up is the oftentimes it comes up in fraud cases, not necessarily intentional fraud cases, but misrepresentation cases. And I think what the trend has been is look at the double recovery issue, as you cited. If it's not going to result in a double recovery, if it's not detrimental to plaintiff in case one who loses, if it's not asking for something you already got, then we should not be using this term election of remedies to stop a party from pursuing what they're entitled to.
Does the concept of election of remedies apply when a party defends to another action? And as in this case, I know that the opposing counsel is arguing that that was a rescission. He sought a rescission as part of an affirmative defense. But does the concept of election of remedies apply when one is defending versus one is bringing a separate action?
I don't believe so, and I think that's exactly what Schwabe says, is that in Schwabe, the second case was very similar to what we're arguing here. There was a contract. It was set up. We set up fraud to defend it. The tenants did in that case. After setting up fraud to defend that case, and they won, and the judge or the jury in that case and the court entered judgment stating you cannot enforce this contract because you committed fraud that forced made this person sign this contract. After that occurred, the defendants in case one said, well, we want our damages for what this caused us. We're not just out the fact that we had to pay some extra rent. We're out that we had to hire an attorney. We're out that we had to perhaps live in two different houses while this or pay rent in two different houses. We're out other damages, and we should be able to go after those. And, in fact, we should be able to take it a step further because it was actionable fraud. We should be able to get damages for the fraud itself. And, you know, it came before the court on a motion to dismiss, so they never really got to what the damages were in case two. And the decision, I admit, and I think Mr. Miller brings up, that the decision is a little muddled when it talks about the election of remedies on what happens next. But it clearly said they have a right to bring that case. And it comes back to, would it upset the judgment in case number one? And the courts, almost uniformly, Head and Seaman, other courts talk about this, only if the plaintiff in case one wins, ABCG Enterprises case. The plaintiff in case one won all those default judgments, and then the defendant became a plaintiff in case two and said, well, we want to attack those judgments. That's not allowed, but that's not what we did in this case.
Mr. O'Brien, how does the approach of mandatory counterclaim mix into all of this?
Well, I think the first place we look is 80207 because Wisconsin does have a permissive counterclaim statute.
Sometimes.
That was going to be my next statement, is, except when we don't. And again, on the counterclaim issue, the court said, what it's been said is if the case has, in effect, the same parties, the same causes of action, and judgment in case two would defeat judgment in case one, then it would have been mandatory to counterclaim. Again, we don't see that in this case because the judgment we are seeking in case two is a tort remedy for what happened before this contract was entered into. We did not get damages for the cost of the land. That's not what we sought. We sought damages for what that contract and what the lease pendants did to my client's ability to use their property as collateral for loans, as the ability to enter into long-term milk contracts. And so, I think this fits very well with the election of remedies in the sense that in both cases, if you're trying to upset judgment number one, then it's either mandatory to counterclaim, or if you didn't, the election of remedies may still apply. Although I think the clear trend is for the election of remedies to just be no longer used in the country. A couple of states have, by statute, said we will not have election of remedies, and in fact wrote in not just restorative damages, but consequential damages, the California statute, for example.
Counselor? So your approach would be that there was no requirement here that you counterclaim in that first action?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counselor, how do you think that Menard versus Lightway Lighting Products, a 2005 case from this court, fits in with the obligation to have a compulsory counterclaim or not?
Your Honor, I'd have to say that I'm not exactly sure because I'm not remembering the facts of Menard as I stand in front of you, and I apologize.
That's fair enough.
As was pointed out, we didn't seek restorative damages when the rescission occurred. We sought in case two and received consequential damages for the intentional tort. And as we've talked about a little bit, that was approved by this court in Schwabe, and I've gone through that in that case, their argument was fraudulent inducement. They did not counterclaim. They prevailed on their defense, and the lease contract was not enforceable. They then brought an action in tort claiming fraud. Chantilly said that's barred because Schwabe didn't counterclaim and didn't elect a remedy, but this court disagreed, finding that the defense, assertion of a defense in the first action is not an election as the Schwabes had not affirmatively commenced an action seeking relief. And I want to point out, and I think I did in my reply brief, that the respondent here took out the part that said affirmatively commencing an action when they cited that part of Schwabe. And that changes the whole meaning of it because there were two separate cases, and the court noted that in saying Schwabe's had a right to bring their action when they chose to do so.
Counsel, if I can ask, because I'm a little bit thrown by the argument regarding whether or not you should have counterclaimed, because, and I may be misstating opposing counsel's argument, and if I am, I apologize. But as I understand the gist of the argument is that you can't have inconsistent remedies. So if you can't have inconsistent remedies, and he's arguing that rescission is separate from consequential damages, you can't ask for both because one you're affirming the contract and the other you're avoiding the contract, then what does it matter whether you have a mandatory counterclaim or not because you can't counterclaim? You either have to pick one or the other. Am I misunderstanding the position?
I think slightly, and here's where I think, and this is the part of these cases that really gave me the most trouble, is, and it may have only been the last couple of days where I started to process this correctly, so the rescission and affirming the contract talk about if you rescind, you're only getting restorative or restitution damages. If you affirm the contract, you're only getting the contract damages, those called for in the contract. If you look at the Collodi decision, which is admittedly, that's an economic loss doctrine case, but it is a contract case. And what that case said is if there's a tort outside the contract, then that's a separate action and separate damages are available because they're different. Tort, you can get consequential damages, you can get punitive damages. Contract, you cannot get the consequential damages. You can get what's called for under the contract, or you can get restorative damages. And just one further thing is, you know, I think you've seen in some of the cases, Head and Seaman and Schnuth and I think it was the Harley case at the federal level, where they're having a real struggle with what should be restorative damages. They're trying to expand that. Things like salary, things like lost use of land are being called restorative, but they're not always really what was called for in the contract.
I guess maybe I'm having trouble getting this straight in my mind, and so maybe I'm having trouble expressing the question. But as I understood Lightman's argument, you can't ask for both consequential damages in standing on and affirming the contract and rescinding the contract because you're moving away from the contract. So you can't have both. So and it goes back to follow up with Justice Crook's question regarding and Justice Rosenstein's question regarding Menard versus Lightway and whether or not you need a mandatory counterclaim. I'm not sure you can have that counterclaim. If I understand the election of remedies doctrine, you have to pick one or the other. And if you're picking one or the other, then what difference does it make whether you have a counterclaim? That's the gist of my question.
I understand. So basically the question being, if you've chosen rescission, counterclaim's not going to do you any good anyway because you can't get the damages.
Correct.
Okay. Well, first of all, as I said, I don't think the counterclaim is mandatory. I don't think rescission and the tort remedy are inconsistent because, again, contract law, tort law. And I think that's where there's been a lot of confusion. And as I said, I admit I was confused by much of this. I've been arguing this theory since this case started without a real, until Collodi and the economic loss doctrine kind of brought it together with Schwabe. And as I pointed out to this court, I hadn't seen Schwabe when I brought this case to the Court of Appeals. And that, you know, those things happen. It was my mistake. Perhaps it might have been a different framing of the issues had I brought that to Judge Lundell's or to the Court of Appeals' attention. The other thing that is talked about.
Counsel, just excuse me for clarification. Are the damages that you're asserting in your tort action damages that were that came before a contract was entered into?
No, not necessarily,
Help
Your Honor.
Help me with that, because I thought you said that and didn't. That's what I wrote
no,
down.
No, but the activity before the entry into the contract was where the tort took place, the misrepresentations, the intentional misrepresentations, that led to the problems later on with trying to refinance and trying to get milk contracts.
I miswrote something.
Okay.
Could I ask, what's the total amount of money that the Lickenhausers got from the defendants?
As far as loans in the first instance, the first loan was for $66,000. The second loan was for $130,000. Those were both from Lettinen's. Then there was a $200,000 loan from the Nielsen's, which, unbeknownst to Lettinen, Wickenhausers, Lettinen had gotten from Nielsen, who was his friend and business advisor, and had guaranteed that. And that's where the trial court had the trouble with the dual agency that was created. He wasn't telling either side what was going on. And so the total is approximately $400,000. And why that becomes important, I think, is why would these people be giving up half their land that was valued at $760,000 at the time of the third loan, was valued at that at the time Lettinen says they agreed to give it to me for $300,000. It just didn't make sense. And so those things, I think, are important. In other words, Lettinen says I was going to get this for less than they owed the creditors. And I think that's one of the key things that swayed Judge Lundell, is that firstly he said he was entitled to half of it. Then he said he had this deed that said I get it all for $300,000. There was no consideration paid for that. The $10,000 was clearly written. This is a loan. And there's nothing in this contract that recited that. So those are, the amounts in question I think, underpinned what Judge Lundell was finding as fraud.
How much money do the Wickenhausers owe the defendants at this point, or don't they owe them anything?
Interestingly enough, at the time the case was originally appealed to the Court of Appeals, if you put the Wickenhauser, or excuse me, the Lettinen and Nielsen loans together, together with interest, it was approximately as much as the Wickenhauser's judgment in this case against Lettinen, which was $775,000, give or take. That amount's obviously gone up. Those two loans are at 15% and the Nielsen loan at 10%.
Is that coincidence or is that an intelligent jury?
I think it was the latter, Your Honor.
That's a
But I don't know, because the amount we asked for was $274,000 for the lost milk contract and the lost opportunity on the loan. The $500,000 was punitive damages, and who knows, because I didn't ask for anything specific at that point. So,
was the jury advised as to how much the loan was?
Was
the jury advised as to how much the outstanding loan was?
I believe they did know those. I don't know if they knew the balance at that time, but they knew the original amounts of the loans. I see that I have 5 minutes, and I'd like to save that for rebuttal.
No, you will get another 5 minutes. We're very generous.
Thank you. I think the key here is Lettinen makes no showing of unjust enrichment for the Wickenhausers here. He doesn't show how they were misled by the claims in the second case. He doesn't show that it would be inequitable for Wickenhausers to be fairly compensated for being the victims of an intentional tort. Really, all he says is, I brought my action first, and so you can't get fully compensated for the harm I have caused. This election of remedies doctrine has been a struggle for the court. There's no question about that. In Head and Seaman v. Gregg, the court criticized the doctrine for that very reason. It undercompensated fraud victims, and it protected undeserving wrongdoers. It noted that the election of remedies is necessary only to prevent double damages, and they have not shown how this would be double damages.
Counselor, could you, under your understanding of the damages available as restitutionary damages in rescission, have been awarded the amount of money the jury awarded your clients?
You know, that's, as I was answering Justice Butler, I had thought of that also in the last few days, that is there a way you could actually call the compensatory damages restorative or restitution? And restitution is normally what you've expended, and you're put back in the place you were at the time of formation. But then Head and Seaman does talk about lost use of the land, I believe it was, and then I think it was one other case that talked about lost salary, which actually was called for in the contract, but did have a lost salary component. And, you know, Head and Seaman called it restorative as opposed to restitution. And is there a difference there? Well, maybe they're moving away from the inequity of letting people stand behind contract law, but I don't know the answer, because restitution has always been what I would have had I not entered into the contract.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time we didn't enter into the contract, we didn't know necessarily about the refinancing or the milk contracts. It was only as the problem arose. So I think an argument could be made. I don't know that it is a correct phrasing of what the damages are.
Thank you.
Well, if I understand your argument, Mr. O'Brien, election of remedies in these contract cases usually involves a contract where there's been a breach. And you then have the contract party who is alleging a breach can choose between standing on the contract and getting damages, or saying, the heck with the contract, I'm out of here, and rescinding the contract and being put back, as you say, restitutionary damages to where that party was. This case does not fit the traditional election of remedies issue. It's my understanding of your argument.
That is a correct recitation of how I see it.
And that your argument is that fraud has been recognized by this court. Fraud in the inducement of a contract is recognized by this court as a separate tort, separate and apart from a contract, and that you're entitled to tort damages for fraud. And your position is, if I understand it, that this second lawsuit is the fraud lawsuit.
Correct, Your Honor.
And you might have brought it within the original action. And you didn't, but you then tried to consolidate, and the court won't let you do that.
Right.
And that there's not a mandatory counterclaim. Now, Menard case. In Menard, the company sues for money owed and wins. The other party then sues in a second lawsuit, I'm stating it very broadly, that goods had been returned and therefore they should get credit. So in the first lawsuit, if the winning party won $100,000, now the second party, the losing party, says, yeah, but I get credit for $30,000 worth of goods returned. Court holds, no, you can't, because you could have brought your return goods argument into the first lawsuit. And under res judicata, or claims preclusion, as it is now called, anything that could have been argued is held against you, that as if you had argued it. So then the question came that you don't need a compulsory counterclaim. So the court looked at the common law compulsive counterclaim and said that you can have a compulsive common law counterclaim if it did not repudiate the first judgment.
Correct.
Got it?
Yes.
And then the court said, yeah, but this does repudiate the first judgment, because the first judgment says you get $100,000. Now you want to say, oh, no, it's really $100,000 less the $25,000 return. And that, now, so how does that fit this case? Now that I've told you what the case is about, as best I can.
Now I remember the Menard case.
Okay.
I think that's very similar to what the ABCG court looked
yep.
at
okay.
And some others. And what they are saying is you are attacking facts or you are attacking the judgment. As in Schwabe, we are not attacking facts or attacking judgment. We're in fact saying the facts were correct. He lost the first time. We should be able to bring our claim at the time of our choosing.
The judgments are consistent, in other words,
yes,
in your view. That's why you don't get into the common law counterclaim issue here.
That's correct, and we did address that in the brief to the court. And
thank
I see
you.
My time now is up.
Right. Now you can sit down, but you have another 5 minutes of this, Mr. O'Brien, at the end. Attorney Stephen Miller, representing the Lettermans.
Members of the court, counsel. There are three elements to an election of remedies claim. Was there an election of remedies in the prior suit? Is the remedy in this suit inconsistent with that remedy? And were there an identity of claims and parties? And if so, under claim preclusion, the second suit is barred. I don't think there's any dispute here that the first judgment, which is a final judgment, rescinded the contract. Mr. O'Brien wrote the judgment, and the judgment says the contract is rescinded.
Mr. Miller, let me ask you, the three elements that you just cited, where did those come from? Which case are you
talking about? Head versus Seaman. There's quite a number of cases here. Seidling versus Unichem, Eklund, Meese are all cited in my brief. Harley-Davidson Motor.
The reason why I asked the question, and I'm looking for help here because I don't understand this area perhaps as well as the parties do here. My understanding of the cases that I've looked at, talk about when one of the parties brings actions for both rescission and then brings a separate action for contract damages. And in this situation, we've got a slightly different fact situation where you have a party that defends and as part of its defense obtains rescission. And when I look at the Schwabe language and I look at the Head and Seaman case, it seems now that's why I asked the question before about what are the criteria, what are the components of the election of remedies doctrine, because the parties have argued in their briefs that it's just, well, if you can't have both rescission and consequential damages, but it seems to be a bit more than that, and that's what I'm trying to get the parties to focus on.
Well, I think the first question, as I understand the first part of your question, is, you know, was there a rescission? And what was there an election?
Was
really
election?
Is what you're asking.
Exactly.
Was there an election? And the reason that is a difficult question to some degree is because over the years, the point of election has changed. It used to be that if you even acted in affirmance of a contract or acted in disaffirmance of a contract, a court may find that was an election. And then it became, well, did you put it in your pleadings? Then that was an election. And then the courts moved away from that and said, well, it depends on if you knew all the facts or if the remedy. I think the classic case was the Schlotthauser versus Kreselok case, where the original suit was rescission. They had bought a farm and cattle, which had been represented to be disease-free, and turned out they weren't, and they filed a suit for rescission. And in the meantime, they had to kill all the cattle, and they weren't able to return them. There was no restitution or restitution of the land and the cattle possible, and so they changed their cause of action to damages because rescission was no longer a viable remedy for them, and the trial court said, no, you've already made your pleadings, and you're stuck with that, and if facts change on the ground, that's tough luck. And then the appellate court said, no, we're not going to hold you to that. You know, we're going to give you an effective remedy. But in any way, to get to the point here, no matter where you start with this, there's absolutely universal agreement that if you get a judgment of rescission, you have made an election. And the case, I think, you know, that addresses that is Brittle versus Maplecrest, which also I address in my brief, where it says, quote, we see little difference between a situation in which rescission or cancellation is specifically asked for in the pleadings and one in which all of the facts justifying rescission and cancellation are submitted to the court with the result that the court grants rescission, cancels the instruments, and restores a party to a prior status.
What was the election of remedies in that case? What else did the party want other than rescission?
I think that what was going on, and I don't remember precisely the facts in that case, but I think part of the issue there was that, you know, whether the court could give rescission when it wasn't specifically asked for in the pleadings.
Well, the thing that I think you've hit upon, which I agree with, is in the common law, I mean, olden days, that means before us, everything was very strict. You know, you took your position, and then if you couldn't prove it or didn't work out quite that way, you couldn't amend for the to fit the pleadings to fit the evidence. You couldn't say, well, I don't want that anymore. I want something else. But things have changed tremendously. You can have alternative remedies, right? You can ask for alternative seek alternative remedies. And therefore, I think that the whole doctrine of election of remedies has fallen in disfavor. Now, not every case, but I looked at Dobbs, was a three-volume book on remedies this morning, and he indicates that very few cases, still there are some, deal with the election of remedies. Most of them do not, especially in a fraud case. Now, if you have a breach of contract case, which is your traditional Do you agree it's that the breach of contract case is the traditional remedy case?
I think when I reviewed the case law, typically the courts were uncomfortable doing rescission in breach of contract cases. Typically you needed a tort. Typically you needed fraud in order to even get to the point where you could ask for rescission. Otherwise, typically the response was, you know, we're looking at a breach of contract case or breach of contract damages or remedy.
Yeah, but do you have any case where there's rescission and they can't get fraud damages?
Well, how do you define fraud damages? I mean, we're talking about remedy.
We're talking about not rescission, but that you get dollars.
You get restoration. I mean, the idea here is the remedy, not the cause of action. The cause of action gets you to the point where you can choose the remedy. So that what you're really talking about there is, are the remedies inconsistent? You know, does one remedy, is one remedy repugnant to the other, and do those remedies in fact lead to double recovery?
And you get rescission and fraud damages, in your opinion?
You have to define fraud damages. Do you mean restorative damages, restoring the party?
Tell me what restorative damages
mean. Absolutely restorative damages. But, but if you want to start talking about consequential damages, then you are talking about a whole other matter.
Okay, these are consequential damages, right?
These are absolutely consequential, if you want to call them that. I would disagree that there's even damages here.
No, I understand that. But if we agree for the moment that these are consequential damages, okay, can you get them along with rescission? You've got to have rescission with restorative. And how do you get fraud damages then?
Well, fraud damages meaning placing you back into the position you were prior to the contract.
I'm talking about suppose he hadn't sued for rescission or breach of contract. He just sued for fraud damages here.
Under the current paradigm, if you want consequential and punitive damages, you have to sue at law.
And
you
sue
have,
what?
You have to sue. You have to affirm the contract and sue in an action at law.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, the Schwabe case.
Yes.
I think is an important case for analysis in this matter. And as I look at the facts of the Schwabe case, there, in the first instance, the tenants, who later became the plaintiffs, but the defendants, they asserted an affirmative defense in the first action, and that affirmative defense was fraud, and they got a judgment on that affirmative defense in the first action. And then were allowed, under the holding of Schwabe, to go forward. And I look at the language particularly at 278, which says, in the case at bar, plaintiff's assertion of the affirmative defense in the first action, for which they got a judgment, was not an election in the sense of commencing an action affirmatively seeking rescission of the lease. How do you get around that language?
Well, I think, first of all, it harkens back to one of the points I made earlier, where the issue of the election was often decided in the pleadings. And I think that's what the Court's responding to, is whether or not these constitute pleadings that are choosing. We're not even arguing that point.
I don't think the Court in Schwabe was talking about that when this language came on, when it was discussing this on 278. What precedes it is the discussion that the doctrine of election of remedies has been subject to much adverse criticism, and it discusses that, and then it says, it's not dead, it's got a little life, although it's doubtful if the doctrine is obsolete, the trend of the decisions has been to limit it to avoid injustice, and then it has some more discussion. Then it has the quote. So they're not talking about pleadings at all right there. In the case at bar, plaintiff's assertion of the affirmative defense in the first action was not an election in the sense of commencing an affirmative action seeking rescission of the lease.
Well, be that as it may, I'm just trying, the cases that they discuss are cases that talk about making elections in the pleadings, and I think they're trying to distinguish those cases from the current facts. They're trying to say an affirmative defense is not filing a complaint, and that's what I think they're trying to do. But even putting that aside, you know, my point simply is that there is no rescission judgment here. There was no, they did not seek rescission, they did not get rescission. This contract was not disaffirmed, in my view. I mean, they in fact, were asking that the contract be enforced, albeit under the terms they understood them to be. I mean, at no point in this decision are the tenants saying, we're not going to honor this lease. We're just saying we're going to hold the landlord to his notice provision.
I don't understand this. In the Schwab case, as I read it, the first action was landlord versus tenant for rent, right?
Right, unpaid rent on a two-year lease.
Rent. Okay. And the tenant set up the affirmative defense that they were fraudulently induced to sign the lease, right? And the tenant won.
Based on a representation by the landlord that you can get out of this lease with written notice, I think that was 30 days or 90 days, which they gave, which the tenants gave. They gave that notice.
Mm-hmm.
So they were complying with the contract in their view. And in reality, they were asking the court to enforce it.
So that's what you see as the difference.
Well, I also see the difference, the fact that there is no judgment or rescission here. I mean, that's what makes it miles apart from the case we have here. We don't have they had no remedy, they had no affirmative remedy in that case. They got statutory cost. They didn't even ask for their security deposit back. To me, this is really a model of, if you want to preserve your election of remedies, this is how you do it. You just get the case dismissed. They did not ask for an affirmative remedy. They did not get their security deposit back. They did not get any out-of-pocket expenses at all. There was no affirmative remedy here for the tenants.
Was there any affirmative remedy in the first case for the plaintiffs here?
Absolutely.
What was their remedy?
Their remedy was rescission of the option contract, and they were entitled to any restorative or restitutionary damages that they may have been able to prove. It was a complete remedy.
So they got a restitutionary damages, really just what costs of the action? That's not even damages.
Well, they didn't have damages. I mean, they were entitled to damages, but they didn't have any damages. In reality, the only remedy in this case that has any practical effect, in my view, is rescission. You know, they already got the benefit of the bargain. The point of signing the option contract, and both Litton and Wickenhauer's agree on this, and for different reasons, but the point of signing the option contract was to induce the second loan. That was the point. And they got that. They got the second loan. And then now they've got the option contract rescinded, and so they've gotten the benefit of the bargain in reality. This was something that came up more and more depth with the Court of Appeals brief, but, you know, my argument, too, is that, the damages here are not causal. You know, even the Wickenhausers admit that the damages stem from the existence of the lawsuit, primarily the appeal in the first case. And my argument, of course, was that, first of all, that didn't cause the damages, but even more importantly, it's not flowing from the fraud or from the option contract.
Mr. Miller, how does the dichotomy between permissive and mandatory counterclaim fit in here, if at all?
The mandatory counterclaim rule, as I view it in this case, is always going to be an after-the-fact determination, because what it requires is that there be a final judgment in the first case. And the Adler case addresses that. In fact, the Adler case says, well, we can't decide this yet, because we got two simultaneously existing lawsuits and we don't have a final judgment in the first one, so we can't say that the relief sought in the second judgment is going to be inconsistent with the relief sought in the first one, because we don't have a judgment yet. So it's always going to be that doctrine is always going to be an after-the-fact determination, because you have to have a final judgment in the first suit, and then the question becomes, it's a non-moving target. We have that first judgment. Is the relief sought in the second case consistent or inconsistent with the judgment in the first case? And in a way, it's almost a different way of applying the election remedies doctrine. at least in the election of remedies. I suppose it could come up in other contexts, too. I think Menards, you know, might be a good example.
But. I was going to say that's what Menards basically, they got basically a default judgment, and then they came in a different court but in the same county and said, well, now we've got these returns that we'd like to deal with.
Right, and I think the court has held in the past on mortgage cases, too, where there's a judgment for on a mortgage, if there's going to be some kind of offset, you know, you got to bring that now. But in any event, in this case, it's the inconsistent remedies, which Adler discusses, the possibility of that, that even though we can't, make that determination at this point because we don't have a final judgment in the first case, what we're seeing here is the real possibility of inconsistent remedies.
So your position, if I can just follow up for a minute, position, as I understand it, is that in the first action, if they were going to be asking for the damages that they got in the second action, they should have brought a counterclaim.
Right. And then the matter would have been resolved right. Well, I don't see the counterclaim as determinative here because they chose a remedy. If they had brought a counterclaim, they still would have had to choose a remedy. They would have had to elect one or the other.
Well, let's say they want the restorative damages.
Yeah.
Don't they bring that through a counterclaim approach? How do
normally,
they get there?
Normally you would. Normally you would, and that's what makes this case a little bit more difficult because there was no counterclaim, but they still got a judgment. You know, and I think that was frankly the way Judge Lundell had this judgment prepared, which I think was not probably the best way to do it. But nonetheless, he offered to have both parties write their own judgment and,
He picked one.
And he picked one without changing it, and the Wickenhausers have admitted on the record in their briefs to the trial court that they elected rescission in the first case. You know, they also conceded that if the cases had been consolidated, that the election of remedies doctrine would have been appropriate. And I cite that in the brief. I mean, and they also understand that the election of remedies doctrine applies in a fraudulent inducement case. See, so it's always been hard for me to quite get a handle on what the argument is here, whether they're saying the election of remedies doctrine doesn't apply or we should change it. And I've never been quite able to understand what their position is.
Counselor, if the claim I understand is that the option was recorded and that wasn't part of the deal, and so that was part of what the breach of the agreement was. If the judgment had just said the option is unenforceable because the agreement has been breached, would you be here arguing the same thing? I mean, is rescission a magic word that we have to either live or die by, or can we look at what went on here?
Rescission is coupled with restoration and restitution. So maybe we do have a magic word here. You know, rescission allows damages, restorative damages. It places the party back to the position they occupied prior to the contract being signed. Now, if the contract's unenforceable, is that also rescission? I mean, my argument, I guess, would be the other way, is that if you declare it unenforceable, you've rescinded it, and then the party would be entitled to restitutionary damages. Now,
well, every contract that's not enforceable is not necessarily rescinded, though.
Correct. And that's part of this is a one-peanut contract, so to speak, mm-hmm. and that's what makes it a tougher analysis in that respect, because often you're not dealing with a contract with just, one thing, one executorial aspect to it.
I want to go back to the language that Justice Bradley quoted from the Schwabe case. And it's the language at the end of the opinion referring to the New Hampshire court, which it quotes with liking it. To accomplish, New Hampshire court says its remedies is, election of remedies is obsolete. The trend has been to limit the doctrine to avoid injustice. To accomplish this purpose, the formal doctrine of election of remedies should be confined to cases where the plaintiff may be unjustly enriched. Think the plaintiff is unjustly enriched here?
I think if you keep reading,
okay.
It says also race judicata.
Yeah, I was going to do all of them. Unjustly enriched, that's one. So you're not going to rely on that for the moment.
Well, you know, part of it, too, is, you know, to what extent are we going to get hung up on the, you know, the underlying theoretical consistency of the remedies?
We're going to get hung up on it.
You know, I mean, and can we affirm a contract and disaffirm a contract at the same time and not have, and just say, well, so what, that's just.
So what New Hampshire says is that's, let's not get hung up on that kind of stuff. What we're really looking at here is, was the plaintiff unjustly enriched? Two, has the defendant been misled by the plaintiff's conduct? And three, the result is otherwise inequitable. Or four, res judicata can be applied.
My response to that is that, again, a lot of the concern about the election remedies doctrine is that you get tripped into it. You know, you act in a certain way. You put it in your pleadings.
Which
the facts
is what happened here.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
They drafted a judgment.
Okay.
They asked for and drafted a judgment that said rescission.
See, at the same time, they had a lawsuit going asking for damages. Right?
That's correct. But they wanted rescission, and they had good reason for wanting rescission, in my mind, because I think the damages claim was quite speculative, and they wanted rescission.
So do you come under any of them? Plaintiff unjustly enriched, defendant has been misled, result is inequitable, or res judicata can be applied?
Well, I think, you know, whenever you have a judgment on a dispute, you know, there's certain repose. I think that's always going to be unfair to some degree, that now we got to do round two. And then I think that the risk of double recovery, of course, is, you know, maybe not particularly in this case, because I don't think there's any damages, period, money damages. But in most cases, you are going to have, you know, in the classic case where you have a land, where you actually do sell the land and somebody takes possession, and then you get the benefit of the bargain and restitution. You know, how do we start sorting all of that out then? You're going to have to come up with a different paradigm, and you're going to be looking at, okay, where do we have double recovery here? Do we have double recovery there? You know, that's, you know, the real question seems to me in my mind is, can we allow a single action with rescission as a remedy and legal damages, you know, and where we can put those together?
What was the fraud here alleged?
The fraud here alleged, as I understand it, was that my client told the Wickenhausers that he needed the option contract signed in order to show the Nelsons, because there was, you know, to show that there was security, I don't know, and for bankruptcy or whatever it was. And, of course, my client has a very different version of that.
So you have two contracts here. One is you give me money and I'll pay it back.
Right.
Second contract is the option contract.
Right. And the mortgage.
One was rescinded.
Right. The option contract induced the loan, which was also there was also held a mortgage on that. My client's position, of course, is that, you know, if you want more money, you're going to have to make me an equity partner.
My point is the whole shebang was not rescinded. What was left was still part of the deal. I mean, the Wickenhausers did not pay back the money yet, right?
Well,
so that part.
That I don't know. I mean, I understand they may not have been, but I mean, that has not been part of the litigation. I mean, the mortgagee, mortgagor.
Right,
position,
so that's still there.
Yeah.
At the end of the first lawsuit, the mortgagor, mortgagee relationship is still there. That part of the contract is still there.
Right.
The part of the contract that was avoided was the option contract.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess I don't characterize that as being one contract, because they were signed at different times, they were, you know, they served very different purposes. I mean, I
that's why I asked you what the fraud was related to, the option or the mortgage or both.
What was related to?
The fraud.
The fraud. The fraud was related to the option. Right. I'm not aware of any allegations of fraud with regard to the mortgage, although I should take that back. There were findings of fraud you know, dual agency and such and such. But, I mean, I frankly, for the life of me, I don't understand how that's fraud or how, you know, being responsible for a loan, guaranteeing a loan for somebody is fraud. But in any event, no, the fraud, as I understand it, is what Lettman said to induce them to sign the option contract.
In your view, if all of these things had been bound up in the first lawsuit, could the Wickenhausers have gotten punitive damages?
I think they would have had to affirm the option contract. They would have had to let it. They would have had to allow. Well, I don't believe there are damages, so that's.
The answer to his question no?
The answer no. But for multiple reasons.
Do you have any idea what the restorative damages would have been, hypothetically?
Zero.
Oh.
This contract was never executed. The Wickenhausers never lost possession nor ownership of this land. They didn't even know it had been filed with the Register of Deeds until Lettman tried to enforce it. You know, all of the damages that are being alleged here are a result of the lawsuit. You know, this is a malicious prosecution claim that they never brought.
They're the result of the lawsuit to enforce the option contract? Is
correct.
That where they was?
Yes.
I see.
Right. This is all the damages in this case are a malicious prosecution claim, which was never alleged nor proven.
Counsel, one thing, I'm looking at opposing counsel's brief on page 8, and opposing counsel asserts that the Wickenhausers filed this action against the Leitmans and the Nielsens seeking a declaration of interest in the 300 acres. How is that inconsistent with the earlier ruling? Unless that's a misstatement of what occurred here.
Well, I would have to look back at that complaint. But the point is that they're seeking consequential and punitive damages.
Well, I understand they're seeking damages, but they're also seeking a declaration of interest. In other words, who owns the 300 acres?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, other than the fact that, see, this lawsuit was started before the first one ended. But by the time the first one ended, there was no need for a declaration of interest. You know, and then this lawsuit then proceeded.
But the fact is they were both filed at the same time, and you're arguing inconsistent remedies here. And I'm trying to see what the inconsistency between the two are. Even if getting a rescission, it would seem to be consistent with what are my interests in this 300 acres. I don't see anything inconsistent about that. That's part of the problem that I'm having with the argument here.
No, I don't think that the fact is that the Lettman's lawsuit was filed, then this lawsuit was filed, and basically then it was put on hold. While Lettman's lawsuit proceeded, which then went to a rescission judgment, and then this lawsuit continued. So then we have the judgment, and then this lawsuit proceeded on the basis of obtaining a monetary judgment. Now, whether at that point there was no, that became a moot point. You know, as soon as judgment was entered on the first lawsuit, you know, so we have a judgment.
In fact, that was part of the trial court's ruling. With respect to why you couldn't go back and relitigate those claims because that had already been decided in the first lawsuit, correct?
Right.
But my point is, it's not inconsistent. There's a consistency there. And if your argument hinges on inconsistent remedies or inconsistent actions, I'm not sure, I'm not seeing it, what's inconsistent between the two actions.
You know, and I can cite the case law. The case law says, rescission and restitution are inconsistent
and
with affirming the contract and damages.
And if I can ask one last question with respect to that, because you hung your hat on the Brittle versus, I don't remember the name of the last of the other case, the Brittle case that was cited in your brief. If I understand Brittle correctly, that was decided in 1932, about the same time the Vulovic versus Upper Third Street Savings and Loan Association case was decided in 1936. There's a discussion of Vulovic in Schwabe that says that the law that existed at the time Vulovic was decided was different because then you had compulsory counterclaims. We have a new statute that says permissive counterclaims, That law is no longer valid. That's on page 275 of the Schwabe decision. So I ask the question, if your argument is based on Brittle, it would seem that Brittle is no longer good law based on Schwabe. So it sounds like you're arguing that we should go back to law that has already been abandoned by this Court.
No, I think, you know, what my argument is that whether, you know, whether the question that's being addressed with my Brittle cite is when do you make the election?
Right.
Okay. And what Brittle says is that, you know, we can talk about whether you make it by acting or by pleading or this or that, by answering, whatever, but one thing is sure. When you get a judgment, you've made it. And that has not changed. And it just says that more explicitly. And certainly, and, you know, even in the race judicata cite, you know, of the latter case, and certainly in Head and Seaman, and the Court even brings it up in DigiCorp. You know, when you have a judgment, you've made an election. You know, unless you can show that judgment somehow arrived from somewhere else.
Yeah. Counsel, if this were personal property, not real estate, and the UCC applied, do you know what the rule would be?
My understanding, and I don't pretend to have.
I don't know the answer to my question.
You know,
so
but
go
I
ahead.
Do believe that the election of remedies doctrine is they're looking at double recovery.
The election of remedies doctrine does not apply in the UCC.
They're going to look at double
okay.
recovery and.
Okay, thank you.
Which I think is solved here by that.
Okay.
There is a case, Your Honor, which clearly says it is not allowed election of remedies in the UCC, and I don't remember it, but it was cited in both parties' briefs, I believe. What the respondents are saying is you must, in effect, throw good money after bad if you want any damages other than restoration. And they are saying that by claiming if you want punitive damages or if you want any sort of consequential damages for a tort, you basically have to give away the piece of land that is at issue here, a piece of land on the edge of a rapidly growing area that is rapidly growing in value. So the phrase just throwing good money after bad, oftentimes when these things come up, Mr. Lettinen may have the ability to pay the judgment, but people generally don't. So you're asking somebody to give up what they have for, in effect, what we call a pig and a poke. Well, maybe there's a chance I'll get something if I get damages. Mr. Miller was asked, is rescission the magic word? And he said, yes, I believe it is. And then he was asked, well, if it's declared unenforceable, is that rescission? And he really didn't answer that. Judge Lundell, in his finding on the intentional misrepresentation, never used the magic word rescission. After he goes through all of what occurred, he said the remedy that should be here is that in this case, and this is at page 14 of his decision or appendix 21 of our brief, in this case, that would be to void the option and place the parties in their original position of mortgagee and mortgagor. The only place he ever used the word rescission is on the dual agency portion of what was talked about. And it should be remembered that he found four separate reasons or four separate areas for finding that option contract unenforceable. Lack of consideration, that by attempting to step ahead of the mortgage right he owned, he clogged the equity of redemption, the intentional misrepresentation, and the dual agency. So in essence, he said this contract was never even formed in the first place because there was no consideration paid.
Counselor, if we were to agree with your arguments rather than the decision of the Court of Appeals, would we have to send it back to the Court of Appeals because there were a lot of defenses opposing counsel raised that they didn't address? What happens? Do we do that, or what do we do if we agree with you?
Well, I don't believe you have to, because a lot of what they're addressing is, well, they shouldn't have gotten these damages. These were damages they weren't entitled to.
Right.
But what's important to remember is that the trial court, they didn't defend against those damages. They didn't put any witnesses in. We had expert witnesses come in and testify to these damages. And now they're, in effect, trying to retry the case. And that was one of the problems I had with the facts in their case. They weren't the facts found in 134, which really underpinned this matter. So I can't say, you know, with clarity that each one of those can't be returned, but I think this court can address all of those issues because they were there. Now, it was only appealed or only taken by this court on the narrower issues.
That's right, it was. And you folks briefed it really only on those issues for us as well.
That's correct.
The first trial, that was a trial to the court. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The second trial was jury trial.
Yes, sir.
Why the difference?
I don't know, but I believe that because it was a claim at equity by Mr. Lettinen on the contract, that he may have either felt, well, I guess the real reason perhaps is because they had four counts in this complaint that had nothing to do with the option contract. It had to do with a security interest in cows. They moved for the court to enter an injunction immediately, so I think they wanted to get in front of the court quickly. And then it just kind of morphed into the rest of the case, and they never asked for a jury. We did in our complaint in the first case. We also asked for compensatory and punitive damages in our complaint.
In the first case?
No, in the second case. Right.
But, I mean, would you have been entitled to ask for a jury in the first case?
I believe so, because we were bringing an action at damages as opposed to the action here.
The first case, you were sued, right? You were sued.
Yes, Your Honor.
On the option.
Yes, Your Honor.
To enforce the option.
Correct.
I'm not so sure whether that would be entitled to a jury case. Maybe.
The posture of the case was in the context of a restraining order. That's how it came, wasn't it? Maybe I'm wrong.
The very first action they filed
was for a restraining order. But not
they filed the action, and within days we were in court on their request to, in effect, freeze everything related to the cows and a security interest that, interestingly enough, Lettinen was claiming on behalf of Nielsen, and we didn't even know Nielsen supposedly had this agreement.
Yeah, so you came in for a temporary injunction, I think, in April. Let's see if I got this right. In May, you filed the suit.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
You filed your suit. They filed in April. You filed in May. And then the hearing on theirs for a permanent injunction was about 2 months later or something? Or
maybe not even that long for the first part of it, but the motion to consolidate was right about after we had filed our claim. The judge said no because Nielsen's are still involved here, and I'm sorting those issues out. Nielsen's have separate counsel.
And it was an equitable action on the injunction. That's why, at least at that point, we didn't have a jury. Now, it may have changed thereafter, but that's why, at least at the beginning, there was no jury. I mean, that's how I understood it. Doesn't mean that's the way it happened.
Your Honor, I see that my red light is up. I don't know if I'm allowed to close or if we're...
One short sentence.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors, for listening. And on behalf of Mr. Miller, I'm sure I speak for both of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Mr. Miller, for your excellent arguments on a very interesting case. That closes the argument on 2004 AP 2681, Wickenhauser versus Lettinen. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when we'll hear three more cases, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:15.